Welcome back to Owned and Operated, where we dive deep into the businesses we own, the businesses we are acquiring, and we also bring on guests to talk about their operating struggles. If you like what you hear today, follow Brandon and John on Twitter. That's John at Wilson Companies and Brandon at Brandon Nero. Also, check out our website where you can find all the other cool stuff we do. For example, we're launching a newsletter on ownedandoperated.com. That's ownedandoperated.com. Check it out. Okay, today we bring on Justin Reitman. Justin was raised in his family business doing commercial truck leasing and financing. But several years ago, he started a second family business with his brother shredding hard drives and electronics for businesses. One of the highlights of this episode, I think, is when Justin dove into his experience in the truck financing space and explained his growth plan for the tech shredding business. Justin is a wealth of knowledge, and we learned a ton in our conversation. Enjoy this episode.
If you listen to our show, you know that we can spend months sourcing businesses, talking with them, negotiating LOIs, conducting due diligence, all for a deal to fall through at the finish line. MicroAcquire solves that whole problem, whether you're buying or selling a business. As a seller, you're getting introduced to over 50,000 trusted buyers with total anonymity. As a buyer, you get to sort through profitable, vetted sellers and close in 30 days. We don't own any digital businesses yet, but over the next year, we're intending to grab a couple, and MicroAcquire is going to be our choice for a sourcing platform. All right, welcome back to Owned and Operated. If you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating on Apple or wherever it is that you listen to pods, and check out our website, ownedandoperated.com, for more things. And follow Brandon and I on Twitter, at Wilson Companies and at Brandon Ira. So, Brandon, say hey.
How you doing?
There we go. Okay, so today we have Justin Reitman on. We're super excited. Justin helped me actually figure out the intricacies of giant truck leasing a few months ago when we were starting to evaluate septic companies. So Justin, how about you give yourself a little bit of an intro here?
Hi, thanks for having me, guys. So our business is actually twofold. We have a main family business that my father started about 35 years ago where we do truck financing and leasing. And we work with all different types of heavy truck companies, from dump trucks, car carriers. We work a lot with the tow truck industry, a lot of specialty vehicle applications, as well as even your run-of-the-mill box truck or over-the-road tractor. And our family story, so to say, also has evolved into other businesses. So we were financing a lot of paper shredding trucks back in 2005. And I have a brother who's 10 years older than me, who ended up starting a paper shredding business. So we got the ability to really sit on the other side of the counter from what our customers were facing. My story, starts where, going to law school, doing the more kind of corporate route, wound up in a startup that was acquired by Square. And from there, had a lot of, challenges really figuring out what I wanted to do. And back in 2015, found myself with an opportunity to come help the family business. And I started off in a truck lot that we had that we were winding down, and started then focusing on the leasing aspect. In about 2017, 2018, we wound up having the opportunity to sell the paper shredding company, and another opportunity presented it where my brother and I started a hard drive shredding business. So right now, day to day, I run a hard drive shredding and electronic recycling business. And then I also deal with a lot of the sales aspects on the truck leasing and financing side.
Lots to go into there.
Yeah.
So you and your brother are second generation and you're in the family business, right? And your dad sort of got it going?
Yeah. So it's interesting because my brother is 10 years older than me. It's almost like a second generation and generation 2.5 in a weird kind of sense, because he came into it right at the dot-com bubble bursting and helped really revolutionize the business and take it out of the typewriter age. The origin story of the business really, dates back to my grandfather had a gas station, and, through that they had the opportunity to fix cars and wound up selling some used cars. fast forward a little bit, my father, you know, had saved some money and wound up getting a car dealership. And this was back in the 70s. There was a manufacturer called AMC, not the stock ticker. And, you know, basically we're a car dealership family. And right when I was born, the gas crunch was kind of, you know, in full swing back in the mid to early 80s. And we wound up losing the car dealership. And my father was actually presented with an opportunity to start a car leasing company. This was back when, you know, dealerships or car companies did not have leasing programs. It was a very new thing. And he really took this opportunity. He'd actually leased a computer from a gentleman for his car dealership. And when the, you know, the business was being wound down, he had the opportunity to go do car leasing for this guy. They formed InTech. And the kind of the idea was to provide leasing. You know, he was doing consumer leasing to friends and some people in like what we call like the livery or limousine industry. And he wound up finding a niche with the used trucks and kind of the heavy duty trucks over the past, you know, I would say 20 years or so, as a lot of the car manufacturers have started to offer leasing programs.
That's pretty interesting. So, I mean, there's like a history here of pivoting, right? And sort of pursuing opportunity. It seems like that, you know, that went from father down to you guys. And it definitely explains some of what you guys are into now. That's cool. That's really cool. Okay. So InTech Leasing, can you explain the company a little bit to us? Like current org chart, like what are the metrics for leasing? Like, is it volume, total dollars of lease, or like quantity of leases a month, or, you know, how do you measure this business?
Yeah. Great question. So the truck leasing and financing business, you can really think of it as, you know, we're essentially a lender specifically for commercial trucks and equipment. I'd say 90% of our business is on the truck side. We prefer titled, you know, vehicles, titled assets. And that business, in terms of the structure, is very sales focused. My dad came from the car business, really, you know, he likes to say that he has the gift of gab and is a your quote unquote, you know, salesman. We do have a controller that handles kind of more like CFO type of functionality. Myself, my brother also primarily do a lot of sales, a lot of repeat and existing customers. And then we have two other gentlemen who help out with, you know, just kind of more pure sales roles. What's unique about us though, is we try to take a bit more consultative approach and understand the equipment. So one of our salesmen, for example, he's a certified diesel mechanic. So a lot of times the trucks that we deal with, these, you know, GVD, 33,000 GVD, like you've seen these big semi trucks or big dump trucks on the road, they are, you know, very complex organisms, so to say, because you have emissions issues, you have weight ratings, the way you register a vehicle is so different than if you're just going and getting a lease from a dealership. Underneath the salesman, we do have support staff, and we actually have a very large customer base in the Spanish-speaking community in New Jersey. So two of our support staff are actually bilingual, and they'll do everything from handling contracts, dealing with toll violations, dealing with insurance verifications. And then we also have a dedicated support person to handle all motor vehicle work. In terms of how we think about the business and some of the metrics that we use, for us, you know, we try to keep it simple, really focus on how many existing customers are coming back and doing repeat business, how many leases that we're doing on a monthly basis. There is specific niches and industries that we work within. So we might deal with a company that has, you know, one or two trucks, all the way up to a customer that has a fleet of 50 or 60 trucks. But when we get beyond that, it becomes a little bit more difficult for us to be the best fit, you know, for a company that's running, you know, 300 or 400 vehicle fleets.
So are you leasing chassis or fully customized outfitted vehicles?
Great question. So when we think about leasing, it's not the, you know, let me go to the car dealership and quote unquote, like rent a vehicle for, you know, 3 years and then I'm going to, you know, turn it in. These leases are a lease to own program. So typically what that will mean is the customer will have an idea of what kind of truck they want, whether they're buying it from a dealership, whether they're buying it from a, you know, a private seller. And I would say about 70% of the vehicles that we do are used. So they're already, you know, completely outfitted. And those types of vehicles will do typically a very small residual. I know you guys, you know, have had a great episode on the leasing and how you structure leasing for Wilson and Company. The leasing that we do is probably in a similar vein where maintenance is not provided. You guys are responsible for your maintenance. I know you probably have like a maintenance program, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah.
And with our programs, it's more that the customer comes to us, we're a financing source for them, and they have the ability to structure the purchase in the form of a lease, but they own it at the end. I think there's a lot of misconception, like, oh, I want, you know, to get a, you know, a heavy dump truck, and then you're going to provide maintenance for that. The reality is no, there is not a program out there that would make financial sense where someone else is providing the maintenance for a big, heavy dump truck, because it would be cross prohibitive. At some point, someone's taken margin on that. So it's much better for a customer to have like a trusted mechanic, or sometimes depending upon the size of the fleet, they'll even have their own, you know, mechanic.
So you mentioned you had a, you mentioned sort of a customer base in Jersey. Do you have customer concentration in one area? Because I would imagine this could be, I mean, you could lease anywhere.
Yeah, it's a great question. So we do focus, we have a very heavy footprint, I would say anywhere from Maryland to Massachusetts, and then we go out to Ohio. We actually, one of our biggest customers is right in your neck of the woods. And a lot of it has to do with the type of collateral. It's very easy to quote unquote lease someone a box truck in Texas. But what happens when that leased vehicle guy doesn't make payments on it, or the guy walks away from it, and now you have to, you know, go get that vehicle in Texas. If it's a $30,000 box truck, it's a lot of headache to go out and get that, versus if we're going out to, you know, a North Carolina and the guy's going to get a $600,000 tow truck, you know, that's a piece of collateral that's, you know, worth kind of the expense or the risk that you're taking in leasing it to someone if, you know, things kind of go south, or, you know, they need to turn back in the vehicle.
How often do things go south?
In the truck financing world, I mean, listen, there's a host of companies that do this. I mean, there's everybody from your run-of-the-mill broker who's basically just running someone's credit and finding like a bank or another, you know, lending source to put someone through, all the way up to, you know, what we do is, you know, it's really our money that we're lending. So it winds up, you know, we are the arbiters. So in terms of our like delinquency rate, we keep it very low, single digits. We used to have a couple of times in our history where it did, you know, engulf a little bit. And, you know, we had, you know, a few dozen, you know, vehicles on our lot. We had a truck lot at one time. But what's really interesting is that with some of the advent of Facebook Marketplace and eBay and Craigslist, it's so much easier to sell these trucks if they do come back, that we didn't need a truck lot anymore. And it's amazing, you know, now I would say in the trucking industry, it's a very old school industry. There's a lot of guys that are owner operators. You might, you know, be driving on the road and you'll see a guy that says leased to, you know, some company. That guy most likely he's his own business. He's his own, you know, LLC, and he has a truck that he is basically, you know, leased on to someone else is giving him the work. So he's not necessarily leasing a truck from them, but he's just working with them as an owner operator. And a lot of these guys, you know, came, you know, from not even having email, just going straight to having, you know, all the apps on their phone, and they're, you know, DMing people on Instagram, and they're, you know, doing Facebook Messenger, and they're finding trucks in Facebook Marketplace. It's like they skipped an entire wave of technology from, you know, just like a basic flip phone to, you know, not even just having like email and a website. It's just, you know, utilizing, you know, text messaging and DMs.
So just for clarification purposes, maybe just in my own mind, are you essentially acting as the financing source for this, or are you also sourcing the vehicle that is to be leased?
Yeah, that's a great question. So by and large, we are acting as the financing source. What we like to do, though, is provide some guidance to customers. So certain customers might not necessarily have the exact idea of what kind of truck that they want, but they know the application and we'll guide them. Hey, this is the type of dealer that you should go to and check out. Others know exactly what kind of truck they need, what the spec is. And it's just a process of us being a financial resource for them to go out and acquire the trucks.
So you're not essentially acting as the dealership, or you don't have massive inventory expenses for sitting there. Like you said, having a truck lot, unless things go sideways on the loans. But ideally, you're acting as that intermediary to provide the financing to acquire said truck.
In a sense, we're acting almost like as an advisor of sorts. We want to make sure that they're getting a truck that's not going to wind up in the shop, that they're not going to be able to make payments on because the truck broke down. For example, we have a new customer we started working with, and they're working with a fabricator to build these really, I don't call it high-end, but really nice ice cream trucks. And it's working with them to help understand the chassis, help understand the build, the fabrication, the type of body that they need. And these guys had no experience in the trucking industry, but they wound up wanting to, you know, get into the ice cream, you know, business. And we have basically become, you know, a great partner for them to help them understand what is the cycle for how long it takes to build a truck, you know, when they should be going out, especially with a lot of everybody hears about the chip shortages. You know, should they go out and buy a bunch of chassis and hold on to them? Because if it takes, you know, 3 to 6 months to, you know, get a chassis, what does that look like if, you know, they need to, you know, add a new ice cream truck, you know, 3 months or 4 months down the line?
So how does a business like yours grow? I mean, it can grow somewhat indefinitely, right? Just as many loans as you want to take on, or leases as you want to take on. How do you hit capacity?
That's a great question. I think for us, it's really focusing on specific niches that we have continued to find. So, you know, we found a niche back in the early 2000s in the paper shredding industry. And we actually, ironically enough, got into that business. We found that, hey, there's an actual business where people are making, you know, good money. There's an opportunity. And I think for our business, it's not only to find specific, you know, niches that we can be a resource for, but also are there opportunities as a family business where we can grow either starting a new entity or also coming, you know, back, maybe, you know, even acquiring a, you know, a business. We are in a group of other leasing companies. Some people call it like a 20 group. It's kind of like a study group of sorts. And most of the companies in there are family businesses. And one way that one of them has been able to grow is they actually bought a fabricator. So not only do they do the upfitting on, you know, pesticide trucks now, you know, they also have that leasing division. There's someone else who acquired a trailer dealership. So it's looking at what are the different opportunities that we get exposed to, and what are maybe some complementary services to it. And then there's also, as you said before, how do we just continue to grow our sales process and our team? Because these are businesses that, you know, for a long time have been very old school. And I think the way you approach them needs to be on their level. It's not like, you know, we're going to benefit, you know, completely from just going full blast content marketing and making all these blog posts on the trucking industry. That might not be how we reach them. It might be more through, you know, Facebook direct messaging, or looking at how they highlight their trucks on Instagram and having, you know, different engagement that way.
What is like the big industry that you get into? You know, it's like around here, at least we have all these Amazon hubs popping up, right? So that's all you see is those, they're blue delivery trucks that they suddenly have taken over the world with. You know, what's the industry you're typically seeing? You know, is it tow trucks or delivery?
So our niches, one that we like to focus on is the towing industry. The tow trucks, also the kind of think about, there are a lot of family businesses. There's not one national tow truck brand or business. And the type of collateral that they work with is very expensive. You know, you might see a massive $600,000-$700,000, you know, tow truck when there's a, you know, an accident on 95 and the cops are out there and you got to clean up that spill. They are hiring a towing company to come out and essentially clean up the entire area. And you think to yourself, how the heck can someone buy what equates to a house? A $600,000 tow truck is a house. How does that, how are they going to, because you think when I get my car towed, it's $100 or $200. When you have these massive spills, you know, these are things that might cost $60,000, $70,000 to clean up. Other industries that we, you know, do a lot of work in, probably more in our backyard, is the dump truck industry. So triaxle dump trucks. We do some, you know, mini excavators, working with some of the, you know, landscapers out there. So there's any type of collateral. I see you getting your eyes.
Yeah, we're ready
for the mini excavator.
Need some excavators. You're in an industry that's kind of, it's not easily affected, right? I mean, like towing's towing. It's you're not going to not have accidents. You're not going to have those things. You're always going to have a demand. So,
and you have to pay it, otherwise you lose the truck. So like that's your entire business.
Yeah.
It's like septic. Like if we leased a septic truck, that would be the last bill you
don't pay.
That
is very, were you, like, did,
because that's the only thing keeping money coming through.
Did you see any effects with COVID? Like, you know, for us, we had a dip and then we had a massive surge. Did you see anything that hit you with that with COVID at all?
Yeah. So we had a large concentration a long time ago in the livery industry, and kind of due to forces with, you know, Uber and Lyft, we slowly got out of that. That, unfortunately, especially being in the Northeast, took a massive hit. There was a time when, you know, COVID first hit and, you know, the car, you know, manufacturers weren't producing cars. So all of the car carrier companies, they were, you know, completely shut down. And all of a sudden, you know, things started, you know, really springing back to place for landscapers. I mean, they were booming. Some construction really started to pick back up. And then we deal with a couple over the road tractors. We try to focus on companies that have a, either, you know, a bit sizable fleet, or we've dealt with a few Amazon contractors that have, you know, 10, you know, to 15 tractors on the road. Those guys never stop because everything has to move by, you know, by truck essentially in this country. And with, you know, e-commerce just going through the roof, all of these, you know, Amazon, you know, FedEx, you know, Uber freights have really started to pop up. And it's actually created a really interesting dynamic because a lot of people will see this, you know, whether it's on Instagram or there's a couple of these, you know, I know there's like the small business Twitter. There's also like truck Instagram. That is, if you ever want to go down a rabbit hole,
Brandon,
that is
probably like already all over it.
Truck stuff.
That's interesting. Okay. Well, I have one more big question on leasing, and then I want to dive into some of your other stuff. But how does the capital stack work?
In terms of the funding or?
Yeah. Well, how do you as a leasing company do it? So do you go, is it cash off your own balance sheet, or do you go inject some of your cash, go get a low rate loan? And then I feel like it could go a lot of different ways. So like, how does it actually work on your end when you're originating a new lease?
Great question. So for us, we kind of take like a hybrid approach. There is some, you know, in-house money that, you know, we put to work, and then we do supplement it with different, you know, lines of credit. Our real value proposition to the customer, and like, why wouldn't I just go to the bank and go get a loan, is one, it's just the ease of transaction. The hoops you might need to jump through to convince a bank that a 2006 Western Star dump truck is worth financing that's at this point 15 years old is not necessarily worth it. Or if you've ever been to a car dealership and you want to get a, you know, an F-350, you know, pickup, you know, as a for a dump, you know, the process of going to the dealership and dealing with the dealers and the salesman is not necessarily the smoothest. So for us, we're buying the truck, we're helping facilitate that. And in terms of, you know, the funding, it's either a mixture of either our in-house money or, you know, utilizing different, you know, credit lines.
So who does the risk assessment on that? You know, you obviously the banks have a much more stringent, you know, they're going to see it as a 2003 to 2003, like, oh crap. But obviously you have to have something where you're saying, okay, is this actually worth our money input? You know, are we going to end up in the same situation the bank's trying to avoid? Is that based, you know, each salesperson has to evaluate that in a case by case type deal?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when we do decide whether or not we're going to go forward, it is really a discussion point. So it's, you know, primarily at this point, you know, my brother, myself, you know, we'll talk through a deal. Again, we do have, you know, some salesmen that have great expertise in terms of, you know, the used truck market and the comfort level with some of these, you know, heavier trucks. So it's really understanding, if for some reason this customer didn't pay, are we going to be completely upside down in this truck? How do we structure it so that the customer has equity and gives him flexibility? So if he's expanding his business and it doesn't work, he can, you know, get rid of the truck and not necessarily, you know, cost him, you know, have a significant, you know, issue where he has to bring the truck back. So for us, we look at, you know, it's a function of what's their borrowing history, you know, personally, what's the strength of on their balance sheet. You know, do they have, you know, the revenue coming in? A lot of times people will hear, oh, I can go drive for Amazon. They're going to give me, you know, $8,000, you know, a month to drive for a box truck for them. It's like, well, wait a second. What's your insurance going to cost you? You know, what happens when the truck's down for, you know, 2 or 3 days for a maintenance issue? What happens? Oh, if you're not the driver, you know, you have to now pay for a driver. So you see the gross, but a lot of it is not necessarily what you take in. It's how much you keep. And we want to make sure when we're financing a truck that we're looking at, does this person have the reserves if they do need to do a little bit of maintenance on it? It's not that we put everything into like one formula and say, we're going to make a decision, yes or no. I think banks tend to have those like very hard and fast rules. We really try to understand our customer and understand, you know, where are they stretching a little bit, but where can we make sure that they don't go off the rails too much? And it might be in getting a slightly, you know, less expensive truck, or it might be in putting a small residual at the end of the lease so the monthly payments, you know, are more in line with the seasonality that they have in their business.
That's interesting.
That is. Okay, let's dive into your other projects. So you guys were in paper shredding and then now tech shredding and recycling.
Yeah. So in 2005, as I had mentioned, I was basically like right in college, and my brother, who's 10 years older than me, had been in the business for about, you know, 3 or 4 years. And we were financing these paper shredding trucks. So we came up with the idea, why don't we start our own, you know, paper shredding truck? Because how hard could it be to have a trucking business? And it was a unique experience, but it was really an awesome, you know, experience because it gave us that other side of the table. Like, what does our customer face? Dealing with drivers, and these are CDL trucks. You're dealing with CDL drivers. You're dealing with, you know, a lot of insurance issues. In 2008, they changed the emission standards on trucks. So you're dealing with a whole new technology in terms of, you know, what's causing a truck to break down. And, you know, it started out as one truck. I remember, you know, some of the summers when I was, you know, in college working on the truck. And that business is really, you know, has a lot of characteristics. I think that small business Twitter almost salivates over. It's recurring revenue. So you're going to a law firm and, you know, on a weekly or, you know, biweekly basis. There's, you know, some regulation involved. You have to have certain certifications. There is a high capital expenditure. These are $250,000. You know, mobile shredding trucks. So this thing of these really beefed up box truck that will lift up with like a garbage can full of paper. And, you know, it was a great experience to kind of go from and see one truck, you know, getting on the road and building it over the course of, you know, 15 years into a fleet of 7 or 8 trucks. But it's a very, you know, capital intensive and dealing a lot of with, you know, drivers, a lot of different personalities. And an opportunity was presented in 2018 to sell the company to a company out of Canada that was, you know, doing a lot of these like roll-ups. There's probably a point in like 2014 where a lot of, you know, either private equity or larger companies were coming in and buying these paper shredding companies. And kind of the short story is at that time, we, you know, saw an opportunity on the hard drive shredding. We were going to people's offices, taking away their paper that had bank statements, social security numbers, you know, sensitive data for, you know, doctors that have to abide by HIPAA. And we came up with this idea, why don't we create a kind of like a spinoff that's just dedicated to hard drive shredding and some electronic recycling. If you're a 15-person law firm and you have, you know, 15 or 20 hard drives or computers, to get one of these big trucks to come out just, you know, for your one job might not necessarily be cross prohibitive, but you know, could we maybe rethink what the business is? So we took a hard drive shredder, we put it into a RAM ProMaster. And so it's like driving around a big minivan, and it allows us to go even to residential customers. We work a lot with IT companies, which I had no idea about the managed service and IT space when we first started this. The idea was we were just going to tap into, you know, an existing customer base, or, you know, we had a good firm understanding. And one of the biggest, you know, takeaways we learned was that one of the benefits of paper shredding of a recurring revenue, there's a route that you build up that, you know, has that, you know, consistency, doesn't necessarily lend itself to the hard drive shredding. But on the hard drive shredding, you have much higher margins. So it's kind of like a little bit of, you know, give and take.
So how many people are in the tech shredding?
So the tech shredder is much smaller than in tech. In tech, we probably have about 15 people. We also have a couple of programmers that we have, I didn't mention, but the tech shredders is just myself. My brother does some operational stuff, and then we have a technician. So he's going out, he's removing hard drives, destroying hard drives. He has a lot of kind of, I would say, more like technical skill to remove batteries from iPhones. So we get into a little bit more of what you would say almost like a concierge service. So it's not that we're showing up at a office and saying, you know, here's the 300 hard drives that you had already removed. That does happen, but it's also what happens to the, you know, company that has, you know, 20 MacBooks that doesn't know how to open up a MacBook and remove the hard drive.
So do you recycle, like you're shredding them obviously, but I don't know, are there metals or things that you could on the back end up recycling or making money off of when doing that whole process?
Yeah, great question. So the business model in terms of revenue streams is kind of twofold. One is going out to a customer, performing the shredding services, and then there's either on the, we call like a resale or refurbishing some of the components, and you know, there's some back end money. So we do work with what we call more like a downstream recycler. We're not taking the product and going into our own recycling facility. I forget, kind of almost think of it similar to, if you listen to Michael Gridley's podcast, not Acquisitions Anonymous, the other one, we had the guy from
Business Works.
Yeah, on the deforestation or the forestry company, how they bring it to like a processing plant. So we will work with a downstream recycler that will, you know, take away the metals, you know, refine them. They might refurbish some of the computers. We try to position ourselves as really focusing on the data security and, you know, doing the on-site destruction. And then there's definitely a unique component where there's some money to be recaptured on refurbishing some of the computers or, you know, recycling them. But it's not like a main driver of the business. In the paper shredding business, there was a time where paper was so, it was worth so much money. So recycling the paper, you could make, you know, a good bit of money from your paper recycling. People were actually going out and shredding for free, and they would do very low bid contracts. They wanted the paper from the hospitals. And then when paper prices plummeted and, you know, there's different trade wars with China and stuff, and, you know, that's where we were sending a lot of it, you know, those guys get obliterated. So it's a unique characteristic with our industry with hard drive shredding, because it is somewhat commoditized, but there's a little bit of money to make on the back end. If you're doing massive volumes, you know, you can go in and, you know, really undercut some of the competition for the shredding side. But if prices, you know, fall through a roof, or you don't have a good system to resell the computers, you know, you'll be out of business really fast.
So how large do you think you can take this? Or do you want to go large? Is it just like a cash cow right now? Or what's the goal?
The goal for us right now is to really figure out what the different levers are. Fortunately, we do have a very good relationship with the company that purchased us out of Canada. And they have, you know, different franchisees in different, you know, locations around the country and different corporate offices. So I think it is something that if we figure out the right levers to pull for this company, we can go and, you know, have an opportunity to almost franchise it to different parts of the country. And there's a lot of paper shredding companies that will maybe or maybe don't do hard drive shredding. It is kind of wrapped into the same type of, you know, service offering where I'm going to destroy your sensitive information, make sure it doesn't get into the wrong hands. And if we can figure out the right levers to pull and have a bit more standardized sales process, a bit more of a, you know, way of acquiring customers, then we can go to different markets and say, this is something that you can add on. And, you know, it's a couple hundred extra thousand dollars to bring onto your business. It's not very capital intensive or, you know, manpower intensive to run this business. But we are in the kind of exploratory phase to a certain extent, because there are certain challenges. It's not a recurring revenue business, and figuring out how do you not necessarily make it recurring, but maybe more reoccurring. And that's where we work with a lot of managed service providers and IT companies.
I like the entrepreneurial side of the lease thing. I think that's cool. I think that you guys pivoting into these different things off of the back of a leasing company is like, that's what I would do. That's sweet. And I'm just like, what else can you do with that?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I mean, the past year, just kind of seeing like small business Twitter has really kind of got the creative juices flowing. I think there's two sides to it. I think there's a side where let's do this because it's just, you know, it's just going to make economic sense and it's going to bring in more money and it's going to be a new business. And then there's the other aspect of, would this give us more insight into our customers? So maybe we come up with an ability to have a small trucking company, over the road tractors. And we've seen so many people in the last year be interested in this. You know, I want to drive for Amazon. You know, there's Uber Freight. I want to lease on to someone. All I need is a $60,000 tractor and I can be my own boss, so to say. But, you know, these things do kind of have a lot of cyclicality to them. E-commerce is hot right now. Everything's, you know, traveling over, you know, the road right now. You put too many drivers on the road. All of a sudden rates go down. There's, you know, it's somewhat of a commoditized business. So you do want to be careful, but I think it would give us really interesting insight into what is the day-to-day challenge that this type of business, you know, goes through. One thing that we've thought about too, what are other, in a sense, capital intensive businesses where we can apply, you know, quote unquote, our leverage and our expertise? Because if it is a heavier truck, if it is something that has a higher barrier to entry, that could be, you know, an area worth exploring.
Yeah. I'm DMing Brandon my ideas on if I was you guys, what, like, just we're keeping notes here, like heavy equipment rental. Like, I'm interested in that. But if I owned a leasing company, I would be super interested in that. That'd be crazy. Because you guys already probably deal with like half the stuff and like big equipment rental. That'd be awesome. And then like landscaping.
I think appreciation is so much less on equipment versus vehicles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a guy that we rent some equipment from. This is like short term. Like, we need an excavator for a day. And their capital stack is like, he leases it.
Yeah.
So he doesn't even own it. And I don't know. He leases it for probably $500-$600 a month. And that's one day of renting it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he rents it to us at least 10 times a month.
So he makes bank on it.
Yeah, boy's doing just fine. Scaffolding, I think, would be interesting. Because like that's a huge... And you're like in the right area. We couldn't do that here in Ohio.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think...
One thing to throw is chassis or trailer leasing. You see the containers come off the ship and they get put on a chassis. It's just metal with wheels and they really do hold their value. I have a customer.
Like just the chassis.
Yeah. You know, that is kind of more in that space, like the port work where, you know, we kind of hit the right, you know, levers on that. That's a nice, you know, complimentary service. And then it also gives us the ability to really understand that side of, you know, the over the road tractor market and have better insight into, you know, what pain points our customers are going through. Because the idea is, listen, you want to offer complimentary services, but we're also very cognizant of, we don't want to necessarily be the one-stop shop, because if someone's truck goes down and let's say we're operating a mechanic shop, because now we're, you know, getting into fixing up trucks or stuff like that. Well, someone's truck's down, they're going to start blaming you. Oh, well, I can't make my payment to you because you worked on my truck. So in a sense, we do want to be mindful of like how integrated we get. Because like if you are everything, then the customer is completely beholden to you, but it can create a lot of, you know, friction. And we really want to be seen as more of like a partner to help them grow. And listen, there's times where you're going to have uncomfortable conversations with customers, but how do you not necessarily have one side, you know, taking from one side to pay the other side? You know, like if we sold insurance and a customer's having trouble making a payment, does he pay his insurance or does he pay the vehicle? Well, if he doesn't pay his insurance, but he pays the vehicle, now we have a guy driving around with a semi without insurance. And if he's paying his insurance, but he can't pay his truck, you know, so it's kind of thinking about how complementary do we want it to be versus are there other avenues where we can, you know, use our leverage, so to say.
I like this a lot.
Yeah, I agree with that. Maybe not vertically integrating, but horizontally. Attaining different markets, like you said, the heavy equipment or something of that nature, where you're not, yeah, becoming the one-stop shop, but you're attacking more industry, more market share into different things. Mm-hmm. That's interesting to me.
And I do apologize for the grandfather clock. I'm in my dad's office, and he has this super old school clock that goes off at 5 o'clock every day. So. That's
funny. Yeah, I think I like that. Now I'm just trying to think about, I always wanted to own a financing company of some type just because I thought it sounded like cool. It does. Justin, it's cool. Like it's a cool, it's a cool thing. I think that'd be cool. But I always thought it'd be insurance just because the moat and you can like reinvest the capital and you can do all kinds of cool stuff. But yeah, I mean, now I'm into, I think I get the leasing thing. I think I'm into this.
Well, it's because there's so few places that offer what you're offering. You know, for
highly customized. Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to get a septic truck lease.
Yeah,
and I would call you at this point. But yeah, like there, it is. It's super niche.
There's one company I know of because I came from landscaping previously that does heavy equipment leasing. It's one company, and they kind of dominate the market. You don't really have a choice if you're going to lease. That's who you're going through. And they can kind of charge whatever you want because besides them, it's either you're buying outright or you're going into a loan or you're going to lease to them. So what you offer and then the way you describe it too, that you act as the advisor and help them through a process, not just, here you go, here's what you're paying. That's a very unique thing. You've got a unique product there that I don't think is offered widely.
I appreciate it. It's something that also, we really try to position it as like the partner with the customer because we have to live with them. We want them to succeed. A lot of times people will say, oh, well, if it doesn't work out, like you got my down payment money. It's like, well, I'd much rather you be successful and get a second and a third truck and tell your friend about how, you know, we helped get you in business or we helped you grow your company than opposed to, oh, we're in a situation where we have to take the truck back and we release it to someone else. That is not a win-win for anybody. As much as it's, yeah, we get the truck back. Most likely, if you weren't making payments on it, you weren't maintaining the truck. You know, the truck probably needs new tires, you know? So there's a lot of things that we want to make sure that our customers are successful, not just, oh, you know, pay your bill and, you know, be on your way.
So I'm reading through our notes here that we had. And one of the things I did want to bring up is the things you're struggling with in the current day-to-day is your split between the tech shredders and in-tech, right? So we were talking about your growth plans and what you could potentially do with tech shredders and what you also could do with in-tech. You know, is there a point where you're going to have to focus on one specific thing, or do you intend on keeping that split focus and hoping to grow them both?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that I do struggle with. Where do I put my energy? Because I can, for all intents and purposes, try and bucket my day and say, from 9 to 11, I'm just going to focus on, you know, doing, you know, outreach for tech shredders. But then what happens when I have a customer who, you know, wants to finance a new truck, or a customer is like, you have to send the wire on this, you know, vehicle right now. I think the strategy or like the process is really to create a repeatable sales process for tech shredders, really making sure we've identified who are our target customers. We work a lot with managed service providers and IT companies, law firms, setting up drip campaigns to outreach to them. And I think one of the things that is talked about a little bit in the SMB space, but it's almost like the longer you stay around, the more successful you are. So we've been around, you know, since basically 2019, you know, when we first started servicing customers. And it's amazing, like even though there's not necessarily a recurring nature to tech shredders, you know, Google reviews add up. You know, people might use you once and then they talk to you about someone else in the IT space. And you kind of hang around long enough and you build momentum. And it's not necessarily something that you can necessarily point to, oh, this specific thing, I did it, it worked. And like, I got, you know, business from that. But there's this thing about just kind of being around long enough. People see your truck driving around. They see you in a parking lot. And it kind of, you know, you put yourself in a position, you know, just being around where you can, you know, generate business. So I think that's been something that's interesting, even though there's not the quote unquote like contracts and recurring revenue. You know, there's still a pretty flow of new business coming in, whether it's through our digital marketing, you know, efforts. And I think it's just another process of how do we educate and bring awareness to a lot of IT companies don't even want to touch the computers when they're, you know, being replaced. There's a liability. I don't want to take possession of this. So we can fit in a nice partner with them. And that's really where I focus a lot of energy for. And then on the in-tech side, I think it's really focusing on those niches. And we do work with a lot of family businesses. So there's a lot of transition that's happening now. The younger generation is all over Facebook groups and Instagram. And, you know, we were doing a lot of advertising in these old trade publications. And they still are effective, you know, with some of the older generation. But I think it's how do we, you know, highlight our services and highlight what we do. I think a lot of the head trash, quote unquote, we might have had is, well, we don't want necessarily people playing in our sandbox. But I think if you can show that social proof and with Instagram, hey, this is the look at this awesome yellow truck that we just financed for this company that's on the road, that's doing this recovery, or here's this awesome, you know, red, you know, dump truck that's, you know, look at the fleet. There's a lot of things that we can do content wise. I do think it does come down to focusing though. And being that we are a sales, even both companies are really, we're sales driven organizations. We have to have a really tight sales process. And I do think in what we do, we cannot overcomplicate it. So many times you feel like I have to have this massive sales, you know, pipeline and process. How many touch points am I having with someone? And it's like, dude, send an email, send a letter, call them. And now maybe you direct message them on Instagram or Facebook Marketplace. And myself, it's really getting out of my own, you know, way, saying this is the program we need to use and not overcomplicate it. You know, with hard drive shredding and electronic recycling, it's a very simple thing. What do? We go into your office and those old computers that you have piled up that you don't want to throw in the trash because you have customer information on there, we shred the hard drives. It doesn't have to be the world's most complex, you know, set of things that you do. You know, and kind of bringing it back a little bit to what you asked, I think the biggest challenge also is how do you go from working in the business to working on the business? And Texture is a very lean company. It's still kind of in its infancy to a lot of extent. And there are times where I go on, you know, we have a big hard drive shredding job. I got to, you know, go in, you know, there and help the technician just because it doesn't make sense for us to have another, you know, technician at this point. But if you're doing that, you're kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul. I'm taking my time away from creating those processes. And, you know, I'm curious, you know, from your guys' aspect, not that this is necessarily, you know, feedback time, but what is one thing that you did to help you remove yourself from working, you know, in the business to on the business?
Got big. I mean, really, like that was it. We got big. We got big enough to afford managers to do it, so I didn't have to, because I didn't want to. I wasn't very good at it. So, yeah. And then, I mean, Brandon's now decentralizing a lot of his authority down.
Mine came forcefully, I'd say.
Because I forced it. Because, again, we were about to prep to get big again. And I don't know that you were overloaded. I think you would have been just fine if we weren't continuing to grow. But the problem is we... Like the way I see it is if your job doesn't change every 6 months, you're probably not growing fast enough. Because my job, I have to figure out how to do my job literally every 6 months. And it's fun and exciting and, you know, whatever. But if you're not, then like the problem is it creates a like the whole thing is a bottleneck. So if I don't move up, then Brandon can't move up. If Brandon can't move up, then the three managers under him can't move up. And you can't keep developing talent and growing. Which is, I think that was one of the things that you sort of mentioned, which like as a family business grows, you have to keep expanding and moving. And the only way to keep expanding and moving is by expanding and moving. Like you have to get out of the way and you have to get big enough to be able to get out of the way and someone else move up. And then the two people under them sort of move up, take on more responsibility, and you all grow as an aggregate.
Is it easier in your mind to grow through acquisition? I know you talk a lot about purchasing more businesses and starting something from scratch.
Yeah, I think it is. But it's not like organic growth is 10 out of 10 hard and acquisitions are like 0 out of 10 hard. Like, they're both probably 10 out of 10 hard. It's just, which hard do you want to do? And for me, I would rather deal with the hard that is, I'd rather deal with replacing staff, making efficiency decisions, optimizing a company. I would rather deal with that when I have $2 to $3 million of revenue than deal with how do you make a sale. So that's just my personal preference. Like, problems are easy if there's money coming in, I guess. Like, you can solve most of them. Solutions aren't pretty all the time, but like, you can do it.
I do think for us, one thing that we've kind of shied away from is that acquisition piece. We've, you know, really started a lot of businesses. So I think that's something to really explore a little bit more is, you know, are there industries or, you know, add-ons? Maybe there's a trailer dealer locally to us that we can acquire and bring something, you know, in-house, as opposed to having to necessarily start something from scratch all the time.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting. And I think, like, with your specialty, you guys have the keys to the kingdom. You know, if you went in and tried to buy a septic company, you would know much more about the riskiest part of that transaction to someone like me. Like, I don't know. I have no idea. Like, I'll figure out the trade side of it, but you deal with this stuff every single day. So you sort of have this superpower where you could go in and underwrite a 10 septic truck business like much more efficiently than I could ever. And you could have a better plan, and then you can figure out the trade stuff or, you know, have a manager or something. But I think the acquisition piece would be interesting because it's really, if you acquire the businesses that you guys are already suited to underwrite, then really all you're doing is acquiring assets anyways, which you know how to underwrite.
And is the idea to look at businesses that have a little bit of a structure in place? So it's not like I'm going to be going in and running the business and saying, this is a better way to, you know, pump out a grease trap, or this is a better way to, you know, dig a ditch for a septic tank.
I would think so. And I mean, we have 3 deals now and the owner's going to stay on in each one of them. You know, usually the owners, they want to keep working. They just needed to secure a buyer for their company. They're ready to retire in a year or two, but they're nervous that when they are actually ready to go, that they won't have a buyer. So they want to take their chips off the table, make a salary for 1 to 2 years, and just sort of like casually work. So you almost always still have that resource available. So, I mean, in 2 of them, the owner's still running them for us, which is awesome.
Do you find the dynamic with a family business going out and acquiring another family business is...
Yeah, it's weird.
Is weird versus... You probably don't have necessarily the same exact experience to relate it to, but like a searcher going out and acquiring a family business where they are really wanting to take it over and, you know, they don't necessarily try to integrate their family with the other. Do you find like a family business that you acquire, their family is also staying on, or there's kind of a disillusion, you know, at that point?
Usually the family leaves, and that's typically my preference just because I think it'd be weird. And I've seen a lot of deals where like the kid works for the company, like usually a kid. I'm not trying to like demean this person. They're not like a 30 to 40 year old professional. They're like 19 to 24. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think that you're going to be long term with the company. And your parent just sold it to me because obviously they didn't have faith that you'd be able to buy it. So I just feel like there's a weird energy there. But I've never done one of those deals with that. Most often it's the wife doing the books. And she does not typically stay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So to keep us just in line with all our little agenda, as we start to close things down, I know there's one thing we want to talk about here, Twitter, and your how that kind of helped you through some things here.
Yeah. So as I briefly talked about, you know, my path, I actually went to law school. I worked in tech for a while, and I really tried to push away the notion of working in a family business. I thought there was a lot of head trash. I had a lot of head trash. Am I a failure? You know, I'm working in my dad's business. You know, I tried something on my own. It didn't work. And it took me a long time to really understand that, like, there's real opportunity here, that it's not like you walk into a family business, at least in my case, and, oh, let me put my feet up on the desk. I get the corner office. I don't have to do any work. Like, it's just a cash register or a slot machine. Like, just going to keep on spinning out money. A lot of, you know, small family businesses or medium-sized family businesses require a second generation to come in to reinvent the business and to come in and run the business. My father is, you know, almost 75. You know, he comes in, you know, still on a regular basis, but he does want to take a step back. And it took me a very long time to realize this. And one of the ways I actually like stumbled upon this was, I mean, I started going to like networking events and stuff, and we did tech shredders and trying to meet more people in like the small business community. But I always found this like disconnect between like small local businesses and like the area. And I would say maybe like, quote unquote, like the high achievers that I found in like the tech and startup world. And one thing that I found so fascinating on Twitter was there were these people that, you know, were going out and buying, you know, what we call a sweaty business, a non-sexy, you know, a trades business. I'm like, what? Like, why would everybody, you know, was enamored with like starting the next Facebook? And all of a sudden there's this like shift where I want to buy a plumbing company, or I want to buy an HVAC company, or I want to start a cleaning service. And it was right around, you know, we were, you know, kind of the height of COVID, where, listen, I've been in the business. I liked it. I really was starting to feel my footing within tech, but I still also had a little bit of head trash with tech shredders. And that is, it's, you know, true, like, you know, sweaty business. And we're dealing, you know, it's a blue, you know, collar, you know, workforce, and, you know, we're working with our hands, and just stuff was not going right. And really just finding this Twitter community and finding, you know, like a podcast like Alex Bridgman's, where people are going out and buying these companies. I'm like, wait, I have this like incredible opportunity. Like, I'm here sulking that like I'm kind of in a family business and, you know, trying to like fight through because I want, you know, to be challenged a little bit more, I would guess. But there were all these people that were doing like incredible things. And I remember listening to your story, John. I'm like, here's a guy, he's not even 30 yet, you know, at the time. And he is like rolling up plumbing companies. And I think this, it's kind of this notion that a lot of small businesses, as we just talked about, like, you work in the business and it's really hard to see the forest, the trees. Well, you know, I got to make this sale. I got to do this. It's like, well, wait a second. What is the foundation that you have to build upon? And like, what could that next, you know, iteration look like? And the scary part and also the cool part is like, it's on me, my brother, like our generation to like figure it out, because it's not like there's some massive management, you know, committee and there's, you know, oh, we have like an incubator over here. It's like, no, like if you want to go and do this, do it. There's kind of a playbook, but not really, you know, you got to figure it out. And people just sharing stuff on Twitter are just like, I have learned more about business on Twitter than I did in college. It's funny because when I, you know, look at like a podcast like Acquisitions Anonymous, I'm like, this should have been
a course
class. I'm like, how did I go to, you know, how did I major in finance and they didn't teach me how to buy a business?
Yeah.
And we have interns now. And I'm like, you need to go on podcasts and like go on Twitter and follow these people, because like the amount of knowledge is insane. Like, how do you run a business? I don't know. Go listen to Owned and Operated. Like, you literally took someone and explained to them how you lease your trucks. You explained to someone on, I was a most recent episode, how to like start a search and like how to reach out to someone. Like, how do you get a business? Oh, you write them a letter. You know, send them an email. Like, there's not this like secret. I mean, there is a secret in a weird way, but like,
I just think it's intimidating.
Do the work.
Yeah.
And the thing that I really loved about Twitter is it helped like kind of surface like all these like rock stars. It's like, how do you surround yourself? You know, you are the five people you surround yourself with. But what happens if like the local businesses by you are not rolling up plumbing companies and buying storage facilities? Well, you find your community on Twitter. And so like those people that are doing those things, you put them into your life. And it might not necessarily be the same way as like, I have a best friend who I see regularly, but I don't know. Like I talked to Brian Sullivan and, you know, it's like I met him in person. Like that's the crazy that you would like have these online connections meet offline. And for anybody who's not necessarily on Twitter, and, you know, I find it probably hard to believe if you're listening to a podcast like this, you know, have a little bit of exposure to it.
Yeah, a little.
I do think the challenge is, though, is, and I need to do a better job of this, of getting out of my comfort zone and sharing. And there has to be a process where you share your failures. It's just something that has to be spoken about a little bit more, because you can't just only share your wins. Like, we really have not had a great refined sales process to Tech Shredders. But, you know, over the past, you know, year or so, we started sending out these like joke mailers, like in, you know, how did the hard drive get to work, or how did the computer get to work? It had a hard drive. And then we'd follow up with a phone call. And now all of a sudden it's like, okay, we're sending a mailer, we're following up with a phone call, we're sending an email. Here's a little bit of like a sales pipeline that I can start putting people through and really defining like what those processes are. And I'm kind of going off a little bit on a tangent, but one of the things is just getting surrounded by people on Twitter that are doing like incredible things. And you realize that not everybody has all the answers, and, you know, share your successes, share your failures, but you really need to, you know, I need to put myself out there, you know, more. And that's probably, you know, if we look at like what are goals for the year, it's, you know, share my story a little bit more on Twitter.
Yeah. I think all of that was great. I think the ability to connect with people that are doing just like ridiculously cool stuff all over the place is awesome. And I know for me personally, sharing was something that was extremely uncomfortable. Like, there was a running joke all the way up until literally Twitter started in December that if there would ever be an interview about the company, it would be anyone but me. And if it was like, because I have always been a very like, I'm going to be in the shadows, I'm going to be in the back, I'm going to be doing my own thing. Somebody else can be the face, somebody else can be the voice. I just want to like sort of orchestrate. But just seeing what people are, I don't know, you just see these cool people and you're like, man, I want to connect with them. And the way to connect with them is by sort of displaying your laundry, good and bad.
No, it's true. Because listen, everybody can just reach out. Oh, I want to pick your brain over coffee. And there's only so many times that you can jump on a Zoom call with someone and give your time, which is your most precious resource. But in a way, like the real way to get someone on your radar is to start sharing your story. Mm-hmm. Because there might be a small anecdote, or they see you're working toward, people want to be around people that are successful and are doing things. If you're not, and it doesn't have to be the, you know, the wittiest Twitter post or the most insane, you know, thread about how you acquire a business. It could just be like, here's like a challenge that I had today in sales. You know, here's five people that I reached out to and, you know, how I got a meeting, how I got through the gatekeeper. You know, something as simple as that, because it will build upon what you're doing and it becomes more of a habit. So it's easy for me to, you know, say it'll be more, you know, interesting now that I've actually put it out there that I'm going to share more. I mean, that actually following through
now, and that's how it works.
You're my accountability buddy on this.
Yeah, there you go. All right, well, we're going to go ahead and wrap up here, but Justin, this was awesome to have you on, man. This was great. I enjoyed it. Honestly, I want to go start a leasing company and buy, like, start rolling up heavy equipment companies. Like, I think this sounds like a good idea. If people want to follow you, where can they find you?
So I am on Twitter at JM Reitman, Reitman. That's probably like the best place. I have a LinkedIn, but, you know, I prefer to interact on Twitter. And I just want to thank you guys. What you guys do is really awesome to kind of peel back the onion and the different ways that especially, you know, like a family business and just, you know, a lot of these businesses work day to day and demystify like, hey, you know what? You can do this. It's not, you know, rocket science. It just takes a lot of work and persistence.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the hope. And we hope to embarrass ourselves every Monday by sharing.
Listen, you have to have that humility though, man. Like if you can't laugh at yourself, you know, like who can then?
It's a good time. All right. Thanks, everybody.